Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Well, Patrick, we had some inclinations that there might be surprises on this show. I think people thought, I was going to say Brody Lee, but that's not correct. Who am I trying to say here?
Brody King.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So we were thinking Brody King would be the surprise, and we got that plus Lance Archer, and Lance Archer attacking Hangman Page, setting up what I think is a more short-term feud for Hangman than something we'll see necessarily culminate at a pay-per-view with so many other people vying for a title shot. Adam Cole bragging about his record earlier, and of course MJF and CM Punk talking about it. What'd you think of the Lance Archer surprise, and that is sort of the next apparent opponent for Hangman?
I thought it went well. I mean, the actual re-debut, but him coming back from injury after a number of weeks went well for me. I think, you know, the end result, I should say, went well. I think getting from point A to point B seemed a little bit awkward, especially with the Dan Lambert interjection in the middle. Not really sure how to digest that as a viewer yet. But ultimately, I think you're right on. I mean, as far as kind of a TV opponent for Paige as a next step, that makes a lot of sense. My only, you know, counter to that point would just be the fact that it kind of goes against the top five rankings in full. So that was a little bit, you know, and that's a glaring thing for me. There's a lot of that pops up here and there. But otherwise, I'm comfortable with it.
I think having a non-title match because he's not in the top five would make some sense, and then he has to kind of earn his way into getting a title shot. I think that'd be more in the spirit of what AEW is trying to establish with the rankings, which they reference a lot. You know, we had that with Jungle Boy
Certainly.
And Luchasaurus too. So I'm with you. I don't like convenient, arbitrary variations of something that otherwise we're supposed to really invest in. Otherwise, with the reveal of the rankings each week and win-loss records being talked about, I do like the idea of Hangman Page going against heel. Is Lance Archer clearly a heel at this point?
I'm hoping he is. I'm not sure. And that's part of the awkwardness that I thought this entire segment, you know, brought to me as a viewer. But ultimately my takeaway was, he's going to be heel from now on. And I'm really hopeful that he will be full on.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, he came out there and just looked dominant, and Hangman, I think, can use a win. I mean, beating Bryan Danielson is not nothing by any means. But fans were kind of torn. And I think what Hangman Page fans would like and what they were anticipating back in August was he'd win a title and they'd have some feel-good wins. You know, wins where they're just happy he won and they're not torn. And, you know, AEW sometimes does that and it works. But if they do it too often, especially somebody like Hangman, who I think, you know, has been played up as insecure, he's, you know, I think legit not sure if he's as good as everybody else in the company or so many other top people in the company, I think there's some insecurity that runs through. You could say it's you know, humility or being humble, but I think it is genuine. You know, I mean, that's what he talked about on the media press Q&A after Full Gear that I attended. He was like, you know, you could just tell he's like, this is great. It's my dream. I want this. But there was that sense that he gave off of, I'm not even sure I'm the right person or I deserve it. He's got to prove that, like, storyline wise and getting crowd reactions that are just 100% behind him and letting him get fired up and do that works. The Lambert thing is interesting. You said it was a little, kind of puzzling the way they got there. What do you think that was all about? Is that also setting up Hangman against Scorpio and Ethan on some upcoming shows, or was it just a bridge to get somewhere else? It felt a little random.
It certainly felt random. And I think to your questioning, I think it's more the latter, you know, as I took it, more of a bridge. You know, Lambert referenced, and actually really Excalibur referenced this as Archer looked as if he was going to attack Lambert first and then pivoted away. But I think there was reference to Archer attacking Lambert in the past before the injury. I, again, I actually forgot about that specifically, and I probably should go back and you know, be more clear on what that meant. But I couldn't recall that specific, happening at the moment. So to me, I guess that's where their connection was. The more randomness to it was just the fact that Lambert even talked about, you know, he brought Cody back up, so that feud's still happening in the background or at some point. So yeah, I'm right with you. I'm not really sure how to take it other than, you know, thinking of trying to tie those connections as they presented them in the moment today.
We got a mention that Cody will be back. Is it next Wednesday on Dynamite, I think?
I believe it's next Wednesday, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although Jim Ross said in the next segment,
right,
Cody's returning.
Right.
There, Jim. So that made me doubt it a little if they said, you know, it was a couple weeks away or something. But yeah, he got booed. You know, the mere mention of his name doesn't mean that the majority don't like Cody, but the vocal fans booed him. He's watching somebody. I don't know if you watched the Go Big Show commercial where some guy's trying to solve a Rubik's Cube while set on fire, and Cody had to watch that. I assume that was taped before Cody set himself on fire and called it the dumbest thing he's ever done or something like that. They had the wrong lighter fluid or something, and just, you know, got
right.
That was not a fun experience for him. So, you know, Cody's doing his thing, you know, and I don't know how that's going to play with fans when you have Dan Lambert saying you got one foot out the door, and during Cody's absence, where he, you know, doesn't give up the TNT title, but, you know, they have this interim title in the meantime, and they give the title back to the guy that a lot of fans wanted to keep it. Now we've got these spots running for Cody doing the side thing. Go Big Show, I think the intent was make, you know, by the way, there's a commercial for John Cena's TBS show too, like whatever that jump
right,
on big objects
right.
Fall in water show is.
Right.
It's like Cody likes being, you know, seen as a John Cena type crossover star. And so it serves that purpose, but I don't know that it's going to help him get cheered when he returns. So I thought that was noteworthy too. It's not like absence made the heart grow fonder, although Cody hadn't been gone that long.
Yeah, and there's throw more, you know, fuel to that fire and that confusion with, you know, the interim title, interim TNT title. That's, you know, that's another level of confusion to this when he comes back, and Sammy being, you know, a pretty big baby face at this point, just re-winning it, you know, in an interim status at least, you know, is it taken away from him? Is there another match? You know, there's a lot of more, you know, questions that really arise here. And I don't think they're, to your point, I don't think they're in Cody's favor as far as, you know, what the outcomes of some of those questions will be.
No, I think there's just got to be a rematch between them that was scheduled that Dustin filled in for. And when that happens, then either Sammy gets the belt back, and there's that will have something to do with how Cody moves forward from there. I'm not banking on a heel turn, but, you know, some sort of
sure.
story. Or Cody wins it or retains the title. If that happens, he's probably going to be booed because they didn't really do anything to turn fans against Sammy tonight. Not that I expected it, but, you know, had they, that might have changed things. So, yeah, I'm interested to see where this all kind of ends up with the TNT title. How do you feel just in general real quick, and then we'll get back to the more specifics on the show, of having an interim title? Do you think they would have done that if the event wasn't called Battle of the Belts?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought about that specifically, but in general, I'm okay with the interim labeling. I think it's unique. I think it's obviously used in other sports, UFC specifically. So I like the idea of it. This goes right back to my issue I just mentioned right off the bat, as far as just them not looking to their own rankings to try to determine a better opponent for Sammy, at least logically, booking wise. I thought the match was fine. Sammy and Dustin is what I'm referring to. You know, I guess on one hand, they could say Cody put his brother in that spot. I don't think they actually made that a point to note, but as a viewer, you kind of assume that to some degree. I think I'm okay with the interim in general. I thought the match itself and the booking of Sammy made logical sense, but his opponent, you know, probably could have been picked from another grouping of the other four ranked, singles, top five ranked people. Excuse me.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope Tony is, you know, paying close attention to those top five
yeah.
and has a say so in how they're, you know, compiled. And I mean, it's a lot to keep track of who's getting these wins on Dark and Dark Elevation. And, in you know, we want to make sure that stays consistent with the stories that we're going to be telling, because I do think fans really want credible rankings, and they want people getting title shots that deserve it. And, you know, I can live with an open challenge as sort of an occasional thing that happens, you know, where you go, well, I'm just, you know, like Sammy, I'm doing open challenges and new people show up.
Sure.
But you don't want to do it so much that it just feels like, well, we say we have rankings, but, you know, we just book to our convenience. And when the rankings are convenient, we mention them. And when they're not, we don't. And they got to be careful about that.
And to that end, I mean, you know, it's kind of a silly notion because tonight Jurassic Express specifically said they are only facing top five challengers in the tag ranks.
Yeah.
And isn't that the way it should be? You know, as far as you have these top five rankings, use them. So the fact they actually have to put that into the storyline and say they're only fighting those, you know, top five tag teams is kind of silly.
Yes. All right. A lot more to talk about on the show. I typed up the live report on pwtorch.com, and it is difficult to keep up with. It was densely packed, fast moving. Did you think it was a good episode of Dynamite, Patrick?
I think it's middle of the road. I think there were, I mean, everyone plus David Crockett was on this episode, so it was jam-packed. I thought there were a lot of head-scratching matches, and we can get into those, of course.
Yeah.
I thought there was some kind of very obnoxious booking in one specific match that I haven't seen anyone call this out yet on Twitter specifically. I thought the crowd was flat. I'd love to, you know, wait to hear from our correspondent to make sure, you know, maybe as TV viewers, we saw something they didn't. So there were actually more cons for me in this episode than I normally would. I'm pretty positive on AEW. So, you know, excited to talk about those and then, of course, hear from callers.
Absolutely. So let's pause here and introduce the show. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, January 12th, 2021. I'm Wade Keller, the editor, founder, publisher of the Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly Newsletter and the website pwtorch.com. By the way, we have a new PW Torch Daily Cast. First episode dropped last Friday called the PW Torch 90s Past Cast with Alex McDonald. And who's the other host, Patrick? I know you mentioned him.
I think his first name is Patrick, ironically.
Yeah, what a coincidence.
Oh, it's
yeah.
myself. Yes, it's myself.
Yes, Patrick Moynihan. And every Friday, you guys are pulling a Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter out of the archives from 30 years ago that week and discussing it. And I am so looking forward to hearing these on a weekly basis. You guys introduced yourself in what your backgrounds are on the debut show before getting into the back issue, which, by the way, I was writing about my cover stories about Jushin Liger being the making his U.S. debut. And you guys were like, hey, Hogan and Flair are wrestling, and yet the headline story is about someone in Liger.
Yeah.
So it's really and then the Torch Talk with Bill Leedy, there's just like cool stuff that, I mean, I will say it myself, like 30 years ago, it was an interesting transitional time for pro wrestling coming out of the 80s, but before the Monday Night War period. And every week you guys are covering it. And it's a really cool pairing of you two. Because, by the way, your name is Patrick Moynihan. I haven't introduced you yet. I'm doing this whole interlude in between before I do that. But you're a big AEW follower right now. Don't watch much WWE. And Alex watches WWE, not a big AEW follower. That's a sign of you guys having different tastes. And yet you're going to compare notes and talk about history every week through the lens of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter on the 30-year anniversary. And the cool part is it's ad-free for VIP members, but everybody can listen to it on the PW Torch Daily Cast lineup. That's one of our three main free podcast feeds. This is the Wade Keller Post Shows, the red brand. We have our main podcast, the blue brand, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, and then the PW Torch Daily Cast with a different theme and host every day of the week. Shows dedicated to ROH, AEW, NXT, so and on and on. So check that out. Search PW Torch in your podcast app and sign up. It is free, and check out their debut show. So with all that said, a little anticlimactic, but the other voice you hear is Patrick Moynihan. He's the host on today's faux show. And he also covers AEW Rampage for pwtorch.com. Patrick, welcome back to the co-host chair.
Wade, thanks so much for having me. Always a pleasure. And I'm looking forward to talking about tonight.
Excellent. So we have our phone lines packed right now, and you can jump on board and get in line. The number is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1 on your keypad. That will flag you on our switchboard and indicate that you want to be brought onto the show. You can also email us at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. We monitor the inbox during the show, so if there's anything that you want to add or react to that we're saying during the show, you can email. If you can't listen to our live stream, but you want to contribute to the show, then during Dynamite or on SmackDown. Also, email us and give your comments and your reaction or questions or topics. Again, Wade Keller Podcast at pwtorch.com. And, of course, the show live streams after Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. You can find links in my TV reports at pwtorch.com every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night. You can also go to WadeKellerPostShow.com and find the link to the live show, or go on Twitter at PWTorch and find the post near the end or right after the show's end with a link to the live stream. Most of you download the show after the fact when it's convenient to listen. That is the great thing about podcasting. And so we appreciate all of you who have done that. All the business we need to take care of. So let's start going to our callers here. And we'll begin with Deke in Michigan. Deke, welcome to the show. What stood out on Dynamite that you want to talk about tonight?
Hey, Wade, thanks for taking my call, man. You always check me first. I don't know if you do it on purpose to set the tone.
No, it's very random. It is not on purpose. Are you running somewhere? Are you on the treadmill?
I actually am. Thank you. Yeah, thanks for noticing that.
Yeah. Good for you.
You look thank fit. You. It's very cold. It's very cold in Michigan, but I weigh about 20 too many, so I got to lose it. So, you know,
you also
I'm
smell a little.
Guys.
I kind of picked up on the sweat.
I wasn't going to say it. I'm glad.
Yeah. Well, you kind of look.
No, that's just the frigid air, which I know about up there in
totally.
Minneapolis. Anyway, Wade. Right out of the gate, man, I hate that I always call the show when I hate it, but I thought this was a stinker right out of the gate.
Yep.
Dude, come on, man. This Britt Baker thing, where's the build to this? Adam Cole was on Renee's podcast and was asked about a mixed tag, and he's like, I'd love to do it. What about the normal people who are just sitting at home going, why is Britt Baker kissing Adam Cole? In my mind, they ruined Britt Baker today. They ruined her today. Why is she kissing him? What is she doing?
Pause for a sec, because I do want to react to that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So I think, you know, it's an ongoing question, Patrick, with AEW, and it's been an issue from the beginning, which is how much assumed knowledge should there be about your audience? And if they don't know, it is 2022. People can go on the internet and find out if they didn't know. I'm sure there's AEW viewers who watch, and they're way more casual and less informed than Tony Khan and most of our listeners can even imagine is possible. But they are out there. Is it a problem when AEW doesn't overtly explain it? I mean, I think it was Ross who said in passing they're, you know, they're the a couple or whatever euphemism he used. But, I mean, obviously you can pick up on it, but it wasn't overtly featured before. Is that a problem, or is it like, everyone now knows, and hey, you know, it's possible wrestlers date that you don't know about, and sometimes they go public with it?
I do think it's a problem. I think for this specific one, I do think they might have alluded to it a little bit with the Cole and Tony Schiavone in-ring interview months back. But again, who's going to remember that if this wasn't kind of front and center until tonight? So I do think it's a problem. And I think we get, you know, I'm glad you brought this up, Keith, because, you know, I took this as the only part of the segment that perked up my ears and eyes, because, you know, I and you and everyone here probably is well aware of this relationship. So to me, I thought, oh, this is interesting, because that segment wasn't working for me.
Yeah.
Again, but I think it's important for you to bring this up and question this, because, you know, we have so many ways to get news or, you know, information like this out. Social media, they have BTE, but TV is the key driver that their core audience will be watching in and out every week. So I think the fact that hasn't happened until tonight randomly is important. So I think it should be questioned.
Was Britt Baker ruined tonight, Patrick, or is that a bit of an overstatement by our friend?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I'd love to hear more, though, as to maybe reasoning why you think that, Deke. But personally, no, I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah, so why do you think she was ruined?
Well, because that's not her character. All of a sudden, just because it came out of nowhere. You know, it literally came. Yeah. I know the first night Cole was there, somebody said you're only, or somebody said to her, I believe, you're screwing somebody in the back or something. The night they said that was his first night there. So, no, he wasn't in the back yet. This is my bigger picture, not just the Britt Baker thing. Guys, how is this any different than Russo in 2000? They are booking to the internet. That's all they ever do. And normal people, and Wade, and I've said it, you're right. You've been saying it from the word go. You got your first million. How are you getting your second million? They just keep booking to the first million. They're booking to the internet. How is this any different than anything Russo did in 2000? All of a sudden, Britt Baker's out there kissing Adam Cole? What? How? And that's not the only example. I mean, there's millions of examples. They do it every week, and it's – I get it, but it's just
– Oh, well, let me jump in, because I'm ready, Deke, for Britt to be doing something other than – hanging out backstage with Tony Schiavone and her crew.
I agree.
So this gives them something new to do. I wrote in my report at pwtorch.com. I hope you're all following along and reading that as I'm covering the show, because it can kind of help also spark some calls, because you kind of know where I'm coming from on some things, and can it can move us ahead in the conversation. But unlike AEW, we'll fill you in on what I wrote in case you didn't read it. And Baker. I'm curious if Baker and Cole are together for going forward, or if this is sort of like, hey, we each have our own career, and we've acknowledged, the so-called pink elephant in the living room, where we're not going to just, allude to it, but not overtly do something about with it. But we're going to go back to doing our own thing. They're not going to be perpetually in a faction. I could also see her being integral in the Red Dragon Young Bucks scenario, and helping Cole choose sides, or being an agitator or an instigator of the direction that goes in. And I'm intrigued by that. Deke, I think AEW should keep in mind the second million they're chasing, because they've got the first million and they're trying to stick with them. But I don't think that this is an egregious example of it. I just don't. I think that the announcers covered the base tonight well enough. And I don't think it contradicted anything. Britt's kind of a popular heel. Cole's a popular heel. So I'm much more okay with it than you are. Is there – you can respond to that.
I don't think it contradicted – I don't think it contradicted anything. But I just think it just – I think it simply played into that. Well, everybody knows, so let's just give it to them kind of thing. And you know what, man? Not everybody does know. And – not on the TV, yeah. They don't. Not on TV, they don't. And even if, like what your first scenario, like you said, okay, maybe they're just playing into it. Well, that's not smart. I don't think that's a good idea. Well, let's just give it to them. Kind of what your first scenario you gave. Good. I mean, and my biggest thing, and I agree with you, Britt needed to do something. And that's not her fault. It's because the women's division isn't good. Her title reign has been terrible. And I'm the biggest Britt Baker fan on earth. I've said on your show that Britt Baker is who you all want MJF to be. She's better than MJF. She's what everyone wants him to be. She backs it up. She actually backs up what she says. She is better than you. She's awesome, but she has no one to fight. So she has nothing to do. She's just lost right now. So I agree with you.
All right, Deke, I gotta pause you, because we do have our on-site correspondent waiting, and he's got a signal, and I want Patrick to have a chance to respond to the Baker thing. So I appreciate your call. Get back to the treadmill, and good luck on losing that
point. Thanks, Wade. Hey, appreciate
absolutely.
It. Go right be here, at
absolutely. Thank you for the VIP plug. PWTorch.com/goVIP. Patrick, I again disagree with Deke. I think MJF is a better wrestler than Britt Baker. And that's not a dig at Britt. I just think MJF's really proven himself in the ring, and Baker has made great strides, but I would put MJF ahead of her. I'm curious your thoughts on that. And I think the women's division has taken great strides too. And so I think the division is as strong as it's been during Britt's reign. It hasn't completely landed where I think it's going to land, but I think it's really getting close to being a division we don't have to talk about needing work just to get to that minimal level of being, you know, a major league deep roster of women. With, and it's not just about in-ring aptitude, which has been an issue, but it's also about clear heels and faces and characters that the fans are invested in. And I really think they're moving in the right direction. So your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, I'll start there first. I mean, I agree with you. If you just compare where we are now in with the women's division, and you know, when we started in when they started in 2019, I think it's, you know, light years beyond where that was. I think to your point, I think the depth is there. I think, you know, there are more clear-cut stars, maybe not superstars to that degree, but stars characters, if you want to even use that term. I think, you know, that's very, you know, been very much solidified. I think maybe the comment that Deke made as far as that not being good is maybe more the booking aspect of it. There's maybe some, there's always room for improvement there. And I think to Britt Baker having a solidified opponent for her title, I think that might have been, you know, I would agree. I think there's maybe a lacking star to put up against her so far. I also think we're kind of in a weird pattern now where, and I think this goes to a lot of the show here, where we're, you know, so far removed from the last pay-per-view, but, and we're, you know, so far ahead of the next pay-per-view. So there's a lot of leeway between the two to not have a clear cut, you know, challenger for her title. So that could be part of why we're seeing her, you know, with Cole and the crew that we did today. And yeah, as far as MJF, I wouldn't even compare the two. I mean, I think, you know, not because I think one is superior than the other, although I would probably lean MJF. But just, I don't really view it that way as much. So I wouldn't even compare the two.
Yep. Very good. All right, let's go to our on-site correspondent who attended in Raleigh tonight. I believe his name is Johnny. Johnny, are you there?
Hey, it's Johnny. How's it going?
Good, good. You sound familiar. You've called before.
Yes. Actually, I'm in a tunnel walking to my car right now. But, yeah, it's Johnny Fairplay. How's it going, guys?
Going great, Johnny.
Hey, Johnny.
From you. So you know the routine. Tell us about the attendance. Tell us about the crowd enthusiasm and how this compares to other AEW shows you went to, and then we'll get into some more specifics.
It was my third favorite AEW show that I've been to live.
Out of?
Out of three.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
I would like to clear that up, yeah.
Yeah. It was so crazy. I mean, I went to that Charlotte show. It was like one of the first shows post-COVID. And that crowd was like a Nitro crowd. And that wasn't the case in Greensboro. And like, I wanted to give credit to the fact that it was like the first show that they did with all the kids out for Christmas break. There were a lot of kids there. Tonight was not a lot of kids, but it still was a more sanitized show than WCW Nitro back in the day.
Crowd reaction wise, you're alluding to the idea that they weren't as into the show as in the past. What were they into, and what were they surprisingly not as into as you would have anticipated, or what they or they were at the previous two shows?
Well, the show I saw in Charlotte, like, people were taking their shirts off and screaming the entire time, and that did not happen tonight. So I just, like, it was so cool seeing that in Charlotte, and I want to see that again. And I think a lot of it has to do with COVID. I think a lot of people didn't come out because of COVID, and I couldn't come to the show because of COVID. So I think we're just in a weird spot, you know, across the world right now. So, no, it was fun. I enjoyed myself once again. It was a fun show, but I just loved that raw energy that I saw that first show post-COVID AEW in Charlotte.
Who were the most popular wrestlers of the night? I assume CM Punk was number one, it seemed like, based on what I heard on TV.
Yeah, Punk was number one. The first big pop of the night was Jay Lethal on Dark. And then after that, Punk was the number one pop. After that was Adam Cole, and after that was Matt Hardy.
Cool, cool. Patrick, do you have a question for Johnny Fairplay?
Yeah, this is kind of a nitpick, but as a TV viewer, it was noticeable. Did they light the crowd, you know, differently in your view tonight? I mean, it was really dark in there. It almost looked like a dark taping at times.
No, I felt the crowd was lit the same as I've seen before. I just felt they did much tighter shots. They were at PNC Arena in Raleigh, and that's where the Carolina Hurricanes play, and that is a huge bit. Like, I think, Jamie, what do you think? What is that place called? 18,000?
For hockey, yeah, 18,000 to 20,000
for hockey, and so much too big an arena for AEW, but we were talking, you know, with amongst ourselves and with other people, it's got to be a buyer's market for venues. I mean, so, you know, they could play a smaller venue, but it's more impressive to say that they're at the PNC Arena in Raleigh, North Carolina. So it was mostly lower level. The second level was open, but like there wasn't a lot of people up there. We're guessing 6,000 on a venue that holds 18, 20. So
That's about what they had it set up for. I talked about that on the VIP Focus on AEW show. WrestleTix had the available tickets, and I think it was at, like, if I recall, around 5,700 maybe was what they were set up for. I'd have to look up the exact number, and they might have, you know, they can always put more tickets on sale as they go.
Yeah, I think as of yesterday, they reported having sold, like, 4,400 or something.
Yeah, yep. I'm sure in the building it felt a bit cavernous, and that, you know, that can sometimes take the crowd out of it a little bit.
Yeah.
They originally were set up for 7,100 seats, and they pulled back when ticket sales were slow and ended up around 5,600 capacity as of a day or two ago. So I think your estimate's real close, Johnny. And, I mean, it's just, you know, when you're in a building that big with that few fans, it's a different, you know, it's a little tougher to get into the show.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but, prior to Punk coming out, there was a bunch of CM Punk chants. There was some hook chants, not as many as in Greensboro. Big Matt Hardy pop, Elite chants. There was a Brody King chant prior to him coming out.
Yeah, we heard that. That came across on TV.
Yeah. Bear Country was the bathroom break. And right before they went to Rampage, they showed the video packages that we did not see during Dynamite, which included FTR, and the stuff with
was it Brock Anderson and Lee Johnson?
Yeah, and the Chris Statlander stuff, and Tony Khan came out before Rampage and said, you know, Raleigh's awesome. Thank you to David Crockett. And he goes, you asked for him, here he is. The crowd chanted Send Hook. And then Hook came out in just street clothes. And then, like, right before they went to Rampage, they're like, we're about to go film Rampage unless you guys want a pre-match. And Tony Khan came back out and attempted to start a Send Hook chant. And there was a partial Send Hook. It was a Send Hook chant, and they just started the first match of Rampage. So I left after that. Was the first match was Adam Cole and Chuck Taylor or Trent Beretta, one of the best friends.
Trent Beretta.
So I'm guessing Hook changed out of street clothes and did something after I left. So, but like, not it'll be non-televised for Rampage because he's not advertised for Rampage.
Yeah, yeah. But you're saying Hook Mania is over? The crowd seemed less into him. Are you declaring that?
Well, no. I mean, like, of the people they chant, I mean, like, there were very few chants tonight. I mean, the few chants we had were CM Punk, Delete, and Sin Hook. Those were the only three chants I heard.
Was it a different makeup of the audience? Is it because more people were wearing masks? You know, you talked a little bit about it, but expand on that. What do you think? What do you think the major factors were? Quality of show.
Yeah, people were wearing masks. It was I think there's just a sense of worry. I think people were just like, huh, I already have tickets, but you know, the stuff is real, you know? So I don't know. I mean, it wasn't Greensboro was more family friendly and more sanitized in that way, you know, because of the kids with, you know, via Christmas break. But I just think, you know, we're in a strange place right now.
Tell me about the Hangman Page reaction when he came out, when he talked. Did the fans seem to be on the edge of their seat? Their champion is talking to them, or were they kind of like, okay, let's get back to some wrestling. This is going on a while. Like, what was the vibe for him? Because I am curious, you know, city to city, and not just, you know, one sample size like tonight, but as he gets featured, if there is a sense of lost momentum that can't be recaptured, or if he has some momentum after beating Bryan Danielson and now there's going to be some heels lining up for him.
Well, I mean, he was 90 minutes from his hometown. I mean, I drove an hour here, and he's 30 minutes from me in South Boston, Virginia. So it's kind of a hometown crowd. It was, as we said, the second biggest pop of the night. He did get some eye rolls on the, I bled enough to fill a battleship. It's just like, ooh, wait,
yes.
When?
Float a battleship, yeah.
Yeah. So hyperbole was not appreciated by the audience.
That's hilarious. but he held the audience. He got a big pop coming up, but did he overall like seem like, yeah, the crowd was glad he was, you know, talking to them and all that?
Absolutely, yeah. No, he's over. As I said, second biggest pop of the night. I mean, it wasn't, you know, they didn't pop because, you know, he wasn't, like, you know, he's the champ. They love, like, CM Punk was number one by far.
Two more quick questions, and then I'll see if Patrick has anything else for you. Talk about Sammy Guevara's pop relative to where he was before and others on the show. I'm still, you know, curious if there's a sense that the crowd is really behind him as a top babyface champion star. I know there was some pushback and decrying him losing to Cody. And then what was the other one? Well, answer that, and then I'll think of the other one I was going to ask.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people were disappointed. Like, the main event, even though you had people liked Eddie Kingston and people obviously like Chris Jericho, and they like Sammy. But, like, the main event, what's it, Daniel Garcia? Is that his name?
Yeah. Yep.
It was kind of anticlimactic that, you know, the opponent in the main event was Garcia. And
yeah.
For all the people that disagree with sending Finn Balor and Samoa Joe and everyone else to NXT for 8 years to learn how to find the hard camera, Garcia has no idea where the hard camera is. So maybe there is something for that.
that's funny.
I will give a little plausible deniability in the fact that Kingston and Jericho knew where they needed to be to get the camera shot, and so you had Garcia playing to them, but it's like, yeah, you play to them, but on your, you know, like the sharpshooter and all that, like, you know, your back to the hard cam is not what you do under, you know, so I get it, he was playing to the people there, but maybe for those spots, you know, maybe Jericho or Kingston should have moved to the other. I don't know. But I'm watching. I'm just like, okay. I mean, that I think NXT has a point.
Cody Rhodes, we heard him get booed. How often was he booed? How strong was the booing? Who was booing him? Were there any cheers?
I never heard any reaction to Cody Rhodes other than when Lambert brought him up.
They did announce he'd be on Dynamite next week, and there were boos, audible boos on TV at that point. That was right before the main event.
Me and my friends were talking. So, no, didn't catch that. And in Greensboro, it was nonstop Cody Sucks chants throughout the entire night.
Interesting, yeah. Patrick, anything else you want to ask, John?
Yeah, I guess two quick things. You mentioned Punk's reaction, but how about the reaction to the match against Wardlow? We really haven't spoken about that yet.
People were into it. I mean, like, as I said, Punk was the most over person there. And I think people were hoping that that the turn was going to come tonight or sooner. So the fact that it didn't, like, you know, it was a lot of wait and see.
Sure. And then finally, just really interested in your feedback on Brody King's debut and even Lance Archer coming back out. For Brody King, though, specifically, I know you said, and we heard it on TV, that he got a chant before he came out. But when he did debut, how did that come off?
People liked, I mean, people were into it. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, people knew who Brody King was, which I, you know, was refreshing. Going back to Charlotte, that's when, AEW has these, you know, inside fans. And, you know, so we get the Brody King chant before he comes out. But, you know, the same fan base in Charlotte, North Carolina, that was, you know, eight times as rabid as tonight. They had little to no reaction to the Tanahashi tease by Ambrose. So,
John, is there anything else you?
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah,
they love Sting. They love Sting.
Oh, of course.
I mean, so we're in WCW country. But once again, like, you know, I was in Charlotte and. The last match on Dark Elevation before they went to Dynamite in Charlotte was Darby versus one half of Bear Country. And Sting's first time ever in the Carolinas since WCW, and the crowd chanted Darby. And you know, and Sting even looked at him. He was just like, "Hey, this is yours." So, but tonight it was Sting.
Was there anything else from Dark that you want to relay to us? With, you know, appropriate spoiler warnings here for anyone who wants to fast forward a minute or two.
No, I caught most of Dark, but the biggest pop was Jay Lethal.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Cool. Johnny, anything else you want to share before we let you go?
No, it was a fun night. I wish they could catch that lightning in a bottle that they had in Charlotte. But you know, I just think we're in a strange time right now. I think when we work through that, I think they might catch that lightning in the bottle again. It's fun, but we're in strange times.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Johnny. Thanks so much for volunteering to call us in today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. And I'll join you soon watching on TV and calling an app.
Yes. Absolutely. Have a good, safe rest of your evening.
Thank you.
So if you want to be an on-site correspondent, we'd love if you attend Raw, Dynamite, or SmackDown to do what Johnny Fairplay just did and make yourself available to be on the show for 5, 10, 15 minutes the night of the event as we live stream. Let me know if you're attending a future show, Wade Keller Podcast at pwtorch.com. That's Wade Keller Podcast at pwtorch.com. Put the name of the city in the email, ideally in the subject line with the date. Just helps me stay organized with all the emails that come in. And we'll catch you up on what needs to be done to be on the show. It's always cool to hear what happens in the building and get that crowd reaction, attendance notes, what happened that did not air live, and all that good stuff. All right, let's keep rolling here through calls, and we'll go. Oh, by the way, you can still call the show, 347-215-8558. And when you call, push 1 on your keypad to flag you on our switchboard. All right, we'll go to Craig in Toledo, Ohio next. Craig, thank you for calling. Good to hear your voice again. Happy New Year. What stood out on Dynamite tonight?
I was just curious about your thoughts on the – well, you kind of already talked about it, but I just watched Rampage from last week before Dynamite tonight, and in Rampage, Scorpio Sky gave all his bona fides, like he went 300 days without – being eliminated or singles pin and all these days without having a loss and stuff like that. And I was wondering why, of all people, like Dan Lambert brought out Lance Archer, if that has anything to do, if they're trying to build to a Scorpio Sky push, or if that's just a, I'm sorry, I'm having a rough time over here.
That's right.
If they're trying to go to a Scorpio Sky push, and this is Lance Archer is just part of it, or if they're pushing Lance Archer legit, and that's going to be the way it is for the next title shot. Because I don't think that Paige is going to lose for the next 8 months. That seems to be the typical time frame for a champion in AEW.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Lambert was scared of Archer, and Archer kind of shoved him out of the ring. So I don't think there's an alliance there, but there wasn't enough interaction between Lambert and Archer to turn Archer babyface. It was more just, you know, anybody who's in my way, get out of my way. But I don't think Lambert was there for no reason. I think he was there to set up Scorpio against Hangman a few weeks down the line in a TV match. Again, you put a heel up against Hangman, give him a feel-good win. I'm with Craig, Patrick. I don't think there's going to be any title change anytime soon with Hangman, especially, you know, some of these, I don't know, B-level opponents. I hate to say that about Archer and, you know, Sky's great, but they're not, you know, CM Punk, MJF, where there's this big storyline, or Adam Cole, a big signing. So to me, this is just setting up some logical opponents because, you know, the world title, the world champion is not going to be the TNT champion. They're not going to be the fighting champion that the TNT title is, basically a TV title. But you don't want them to become, you know, The Rock or Brock Lesnar, where it's like you just rarely see them wrestle. Even Roman Reigns, you know, doesn't wrestle on TV much. I think AEW with Hangman Page especially wants him to be a fighting champion and very visible and in the ring, getting in reps and getting some wins. So I just thought this segment served to set up a couple matches that just happened to overlap a little bit in terms of the angle to set them up.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I think Paige will see him as champion for some time, as you both said. I also just think, I mean, this is a good example of the larger episode where it was really a storyline-driven episode of Dynamite with, obviously, you know, a lot of matches in there, but every single second almost of this two-hour show was to set up another storyline or enhance, you know, a storyline that's already, you know, in motion. And I think this is a good example of that as a microcosm of the show. So agreed. I mean, I think this is just, and I guess I'll just, you know, add that I didn't take the Lambert Archer connection to be something that would be furthered along. I do think it was just kind of, you know, something that gets from one point to the other in the segment.
Yeah. I mean, I think Tony Khan will think about this show a week or a month from now and think that's when Archer returned and that's when Brody King debuted. And it's where we established Cole and Britt Baker on camera together, and then we also forwarded the Jericho Kingston storyline, the Punk MJF Wardlow storyline, and continued a bit of a elevated push for Powerhouse Hobbs, even though he lost to Dante. I mean, I think this is, you know, a more high profile position for him, and then, you know, establishing Hangman's kind of B level opponents. But other than that, I mean, and I guess, you know, just the next step in Acclaimed and Sting and Darby, I think he just thinks we checked enough boxes. We gave the fans enough. I don't think he's going to see it as a marquee show because it wasn't designed to be. But I think he's looking, did I give the fans their money's worth in the building? Well, part of that depends on, you know, what's going on right now as we talk for Rampage. But it wasn't a marquee main event relative to some others. You know, with all due respect to Sammy Guevara, I think he's a little cooled off. And Danny Garcia is great, but he's not, you know, he's hanging out with 2.0 and he's not a main event talent and hasn't been portrayed as such. So I think Tony looks at this as a show that delivered some surprises and supporting of storylines and enough appearances of big stars. No Moxley for obvious reasons, no Kenny for obvious reasons, but you got Jericho, you got the Young Bucks who don't always appear on Dynamite, and you got Sting, and you got the world champion Hangman Page, and you got CM Punk and MJF. I mean, there were enough big stars on this show. I think in the end, I'm kind of talking macro here, Tony's going to think, hey, yeah, it wasn't an A show in terms of marquee matchups, but it was, you know, he gave the viewers a lot. And frankly, you got to have, in order for there to be an above average show, you have to have average and below average shows. You just want the range to be not too broad between the best and the worst shows, and you want the average to be still really good. And you had talked about, Patrick, this being a frustrating show in a number of ways. Elaborate on that a little bit more, and what you think about what I said in terms of if Tony's trying to rationalize this being a good enough show, at least.
Yeah, I mean, when you summed it up just now, Wade, with those kind of bullet points, that sounds like a really darn good show to me in those kind of nutshell segments. You know, but to your point, I mean, a lot of the things that just kind of fell flat, I mean, we talked about this with Johnny just now, but just at a high level, the crowd just came off very flat on TV. For whatever reason, the reasons we talked about potentially being the case. And I just think that we just had a lot, again, back to my, you know, comment about this being storyline driven and storyline heavy. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But I just feel like it also kind of led to the fact that almost everyone on the roster felt like they had to have a moment, within the show. And again, I think, you know, some of the weird matches on paper, just seeing the, you know, the tag match with the Acclaimed and Bronson and Bear Boulder, and then the Matt Hardy Penta match, just again, just kind of awkward. But I think the biggest booking question mark I had was in the Punk Wardlow match. Mm-hmm. It really had to do with that Punk going through a table with the powerbomb and the ref just being literally right there and not calling for a DQ. It was just so confounding to me. I actually had to go and Google and just make sure that this was not meant to be a no DQ match, or I thought I missed something. And it was just so odd. And even someone like JR, who's usually on top of this and would call it right out, I could be wrong here, but I did not hear him say anything about that. And then, you know, I'm okay with Punk winning. It's fine. But after 7 power bombs, then an ace through a table, which did not cause a DQ, then he's able to make it back into the ring and then get the win. It was just an odd flow of events for me, and it just really put me right out of it.
Yeah, I was wondering about, does AEW have rules, and does powerbombing someone through a table constitute a DQ? And I'm curious, I don't have memorized like what their history is in that regard. Is ringside action, including powerbombs through tables, throwing people into ring posts, hitting people with chairs, is that legal? And if so, what then constitutes a street fight when everything is legal, if nothing is illegal? And I guess, it's frustrating. And I've sort of just thought, okay, when you watch AEW, that's going to be one of the things that they're not going to be particularly careful about. But it did cross my mind too. The number of power bombs to come back from that, including being power bombed through a table, and then still get a small package win. If it was just a match without an angle, it'd be more annoying. This was a match that was with a story told to prove a point, which is, you know, MJF wanted Wardlow to take Punk out of action. He didn't care about Wardlow winning, and that ultimately cost Wardlow the win. It was sort of the last gasp of energy Punk had after Wardlow got a little bit sidetracked by MJF yelling for instructions at him, and then Punk was selling a lot afterwards. I think, because I talked about this yesterday in my Focus on AEW podcast for VIP members, I was really intrigued by this lineup in terms of what they would do with Powerhouse Hobbs and Dante and Wardlow and Punk, especially because you just can't imagine either guy losing, you know, and under normal circumstances. But AEW doesn't tend to do ref bumps. Well, they don't do ref bumps. They don't tend to do distraction finishes in the way that WWE does, and they certainly don't do DQ finishes. So I was expecting a 3 count. And I'm watching this going, where's the out? You know, they're not going to have Wardlow powerbomb him 6 times and score 1, 2, 3. They're not going to do that to Punk.
Sure.
But they told the story that Wardlow dominated Punk. And I think ultimately, you know, people are maybe going to be thinking what you're thinking, and maybe they were pulled out of being invested in the match because of it. But the lasting story is Wardlow dominated CM Punk. CM Punk didn't lose. He was resilient. But AEW booked Wardlow, if you're thinking in a meta sense, they protected Wardlow big time against Punk. And in a storyline sense, just immersed in things, wow, you know, Wardlow beat up Punk, and he would have won if it weren't for MJF being worried about getting Punk so worn out that he wouldn't be a threat to him in a one-on-one match. So I thought there was enough storyline substance to get me through some of the issues you expressed that also crossed my mind watching it, and also because it was a bit of a conundrum when they booked the match. You know, I mean, I don't know if there was a better finish. So I throw it to you. You can react to what I said, but also what would you have done? Like, what did you imagine when they announced this match would be a finish that would serve all the purposes and protect all the people they needed to protect this?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I'm 100% on board with this really being a vehicle to serve the purpose of exactly what they did. They furthered the MJF Punk feud. They, you know, really even furthered the tease between MJF and Wardlow, things like that. I'm all on board. I think they could have actually done everything that they did tonight, but if they wanted to have Wardlow lose as he did, they could have just had that DQ come into play on that powerbomb through the table. And in the same sense, he could have been mad, Wardlow, that is. He could have been mad at MJF because MJF was the one to tell him to do that, and that caused him to lose the match via DQ, but still. So I think they probably could have done mostly everything that they did and come away and, you know, with a similar outcome.
Yeah, they do not like doing DQ finishes.
Correct,
you know? And the question is, are they too adherent to that? You know, is this a time to do that? I also was wondering, you know, the next match they announced was a 20-minute time limit. I was starting to think, are they just going to do a time limit draw here? You know, like, because I didn't know if it was 15 or 20 or 30, but they had a 20-minute time limit elsewhere on the show. This went, I think, about 14. 6 minutes would have been pushing it. But I was starting to think, are they just going to have Wardlow, like, you know, beat up Punk long enough that the belt ring? I don't know if that would have, you know, been any better, and that would have, you know, certainly filled more TV time than they wanted. So,
yeah, but yeah, and I think, you know, I think it's just really, I guess I'll just leave it there. I mean, I think it ended up being serving its purpose. I totally understood. I just think it's kind of just, you're just confusing people that actually care about, you know, their rules, as, you know, watching this, and you know, if AEW is not caring or not considering these things, and I think people are going to start questioning them. And like, you know, like the caller earlier, he's questioning things about, you know, Baker being on screen with Cole and just things these pop up maybe in and of themselves, they're not important, but they could be growing as you kind of rally them off.
Yep. All right, I'll throw it back to Craig. Do you want to follow up on any of that or add something else?
Yeah, the problem I had with the CM Punk match was that wasn't a small package. That was a large package. With a dude that had just gotten the crap kicked out of him, scooping up this giant dude so slowly, they wouldn't even show the replay of it. Because I was like, that must have been the slowest and most awkward small package in history. It just felt so weird. And you know, I understand where they were going with the angle and stuff like that, but yeah, that was bad. That's all I got, guys. Thanks for taking my call, and have a great night.
Great, thanks, Frank.
Thanks.
Yep, take care. All right, we'll go to Ryan next, and then after that, Hinton. Ryan in Cumberland, Maryland, thanks for calling. What stood out on Dynamite for you tonight?
Now, got a question on Wardlow with his match with CM Punk. Do you think to get to the next level, he should be working like used to work for IWC, which was a pretty big independent league. They get like over 1,000 fans sometimes to their shows. I think that would help him become a main eventer, because I think it's hard to really learn your craft only wrestling like 50 times, because Batista had that advantage of wrestling like 150 times, become, you know, like a star like once a year. And it's like three times as many matches.
Yeah, I mean, reps are an issue. You know, AEW, fortunately, Tony does AEW Dark and did throughout the pandemic and kept people in ring shape, kept their timing up. Wardlow, you know, they're going to lean on him pretty quickly to be against top-level opponents and have longer matches. You know, we'll see how quickly he adapts. How do you think he looked tonight, Patrick, in terms of just being in a longer match, not just executing moves and selling, but body language, owning the ring, holding up his cardio, you know, emoting? Just overall, did his stock go up tonight?
Oh, I certainly think it did. I think just, you know, even the short video package they gave him right before his entrance, that was huge. And just brand new ring gear to kind of accentuate, I think, his character more. And I think the one thing that was impressive, I think two things, you know, two people rather, himself and, you know, Powerhouse Hobbs separately, I think they really popped out to me as far as, you know, furthering themselves from a character standpoint and really owning who they are from, again, the look, the demeanor, et cetera. So, yeah, I certainly would agree.
Yeah. Ryan, any follow-up on any of that or another topic?
Another topic I have is on the Pro Wrestling Illustrated Awards. Are they still, like, rigging those and not actually doing fan voting? Because it seemed like maybe they worked out a deal with AEW to get their name mentioned a whole bunch of times on the show today.
Yeah. I haven't looked at the awards issue yet to see how distributed the awards were. So I would be an uninformed speculator at this point in terms of that. I mean, I know back in the day, you know, the Road Warriors won Tag Team of the Year in like the mid-80s, and I remember being crestfallen when I realized that the photo was taken and they had tag team titles in the photo with the award plaque that they lost before the award balloting started. And so the, you know, PWI photographers like were like, all right, we got these plaques, you're gonna be the winners, so let's take your picture. But then they lost the belts and they appeared in the magazine with belts that they lost before balloting began. And there was other inconsistencies too that my sleuth detective work pinpointed. It was a haircut of somebody. They had really long hair while they were holding the plaque, and then they got a haircut during balloting. So I was like, all right, this is all faked.
Sorry to cut you off, Wade. I was just going to ask, was this when your kayfabe facade was shattered, those moments right there?
I was suspicious for a while about many things, but I was thinking maybe PWI was a bastion of integrity when it came to voting, and so
right.
That was shattered. I remember interviewing Bill Apter, I don't know, you know, 10 years ago, give or take, and he was still a little bit not wanting to exactly address that issue about the awards, because, I mean, people put stamps, you know, they filled out the ballots, and they put them in envelopes, and they paid a stamp, and you know, it's a little fraudulent to not do that. Now, it's possible PWI had a lot of wrestlers pose with plaques who they all thought would be leading contenders. This is what Bill Apter should have said if he wanted to lie and give us a story to believe in. We all the people we thought might win, any chance we saw them, we had them hold up the plaques, and then whoever won, those photos would run. And then we didn't give them the plaques to keep until they officially won. I guess you could make some sort of, you know, story around that. That's just a little piece of history. So, yes, I don't put it at all past PWI to be giving out awards that they think are deserved, but also based on who might mention them on TV. But I don't know, you know, because they've had changes in management and editorial board, and I just don't know enough about their approach right now. Patrick, do you?
No, I can't say. I just heard some of the news come out today and, you know, saw some pictures on Twitter as far as I think the cover and the back page, a lot of AEW wins in the various award categories, but I haven't, you know, gotten to the full results yet myself.
Yeah. So, I wish I had a better answer for you, Ryan. When I see the awards in more detail, I'll you know, give my thoughts. Nobody who won seemed like an egregious, you know, PR move, you know, but, you know, WWE's not going to probably mention PWI on TV, and it's good publicity for PWI, and I think Tony Khan thinks it's pretty cool to be talking about Pro Wrestling Illustrated Awards on a show. You know, I mean, I'm sure it's something that he dreamed of, you know, in the, you know, 90s when he was imagining having this job someday.
Okay. And I guess my final question is, we see the probability of Sting and Darby Allin being the tag team champions this year. Is that too far out of possibility?
Interesting. So we've got Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus with the belts now. I don't really imagine a Sting-Darby match challenging them. But down the line, Patrick, once the belts change hands, I wouldn't rule that out at all. I hesitate and kind of think, you know, do you want to put that – you want to put the title belts around someone Sting's age, but then I also think, wouldn't it be cool if you're Tony Khan to think about the AEW tag team title lineage, including Sting, as somebody who held one of those belts? And I could imagine him, you know, that appealing to him. And things looked, you know, more than passable in the ring. And, you know, Darby can do the majority of the work. So, as I think it through, I wouldn't rule it out. What do you think, Patrick?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but thinking about the question now, I would agree. I wouldn't rule that out at all. I mean, I think the last maybe 2-3 years of pro wrestling, there's a lot of things that we probably wouldn't expect to have seen. So
yeah.
I think this would be something that I would put right up there.
Yeah. Good topics, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we'll go to Hinton next, and then on deck, Bryant in Boston. Hinton, thanks for calling. What'd you think of Dynamite tonight?
Hey guys, hey Patrick, hey Wade. I thought it was a good show, but I understand that the talking et cetera can probably be a turnoff to the normal AEW viewer. I want to very quickly correct fact check the first caller that we had. So he mentioned that AEW placed their first man, and I fully agree with that. I've made that case here over and over again, and the Torch itself has made that case. But I think his facts were somewhat off. So, first of all, it was Cole himself that acknowledged that he was in a relationship with Britt Baker on TV when he made his debut, when he made his television debut to Tony Schiavone. And then Deke was referring to an altercation that involved Ruby Soho and Britt Baker that happened on Rampage several weeks after that. So he was making a good point. He just wasn't citing the right evidence. I just wanted to get that out there. Baker's role. You mentioned that that Baker could play a role with Red Dragon, Young Bucks, that whole thing. I personally hope that doesn't happen because while I'm sure Britt would be okay with it, to me it just plays into this harmful trope of portraying a woman as being like this source of discord among male friends, now that Yoko Ono type of vibe. And I've just seen that happen too many times in movies and television, even in WWE. So I don't care to see it again. I hope it's just a one-time sort of association and they move on.
We saw a variation of that hint with Red Velvet and Chris Statlander and Layla Hirsch, where it was like, you know, you can just imagine Jerry Lawler going, these girls, they don't never get along. Every wrestler, you know, every whatever his cliche was, every woman hates every other woman. And it was just like, it just got so tired. It's like, you know, it just felt really dated and inappropriate. But they're kind of playing that up here, you know, where the women aren't getting along. That said, the Bucks aren't getting along with Red Dragon. You know, I mean, like, there's tons of people not getting along with each other and who are, you know, supposedly aligned. And having issues, you know, I don't think Jericho and Kingston count because they aren't really aligned. They're just on each other's nerves. But nevertheless, I think you got to be kind of cognizant of that because of history. And, you know, it doesn't mean that you have to, you know, walk on eggshells about everything. But I think being cognizant of, are we playing into something that has been a bad stereotype and, frankly, you know, built on decades of sexism, do we want to try to avoid that? Just to be more entertaining and market to a wider audience that isn't going to roll their eyes or be upset at something like that. So, I mean, I think you make a valid point as far as that goes. I still wouldn't rule out that they do it, you know, but they should do it well. And at least she wasn't coming in creating discord. You know, there was already discord when she came in. It's more her just choosing sides.
Yeah, fair enough. And I just worry because Baker has played into a lot of the borderline sort of sexist writing at times, especially with her feud with Ruby Soho. Like that promo battle, which everyone was raving about on Rampage. And to me, it's like, you're talking about who, you know, people banging backstage and, you know, all of this stuff that I'd imagine those XTNA writers writing. And just to sort of stick to the women's stuff. So you mentioned the backstage thing with Chris Statlander, Layla Hirsch. I'm liking that little storyline. I thought the acting was a little wooden by them. And also the women's match today, the G versus Sheeta match, there's a screwy finish at the end, and that felt a little flat to me. And that was one of the weaker points of the show. I genuinely don't like stopping a match for kicking too much ass just as a matter of principle. And I've also kind of forgotten about how the feud started. I mean, I do like the fact that there is a blood feud in like the women's mid card, which is an improvement that AEW has made. I'm just worried that this is going to lead to an unsanctioned lights out match, which AEW is just always like finding this excuse to do between their wrestlers, even though they receive, like, you know, 2 minutes of TV time here, two, like 30 seconds here, 30 seconds there, and then, oh, all of a sudden we have an unsanctioned match. So, and I'm also not really, just a personal thing, I don't like Serena Deeb as a heel very much. I think maybe it's because I've heard her too much outside the ring. She's just way too likable. So what did you guys think of the match itself and where the rivalry's heading?
Yeah, Patrick, what did you think of that? I was wondering when you at the top of the show, if that was one of the things that you didn't like.
Oh, no, actually, ironically, no, it wasn't. I think it served its purpose. I think if I have a gripe here, I'm kind of ready for this feud to be over. I do agree with you, though, Hayden. I love that this is a blood feud of sorts, and I don't think we've seen many of those lately. So to have this kind of in that mid-card, especially on the women's side of the division, I think that's really great to see. I was okay with this because I think that it, aside from merely not really being in love with, you know, seeing a fifth match, I thought that Deeb got some heat back. She had lost at least the last, you know, maybe one or two matches between the two. I think, you know, they're really going full heel with her. They gave her some time last week with a sit down with JR. So, I mean, I think they're just investing in her a little bit more. So with that said, you know, if it puts Sheeta out of action for a little bit, potentially, maybe that's where they go as the next step, just kind of having her on the back burner as Deeb kind of furthers that heel persona and, you know, maybe get some wins over some others in the division. I think that would be great.
I talked yesterday on the VIP podcast about, you know, they could give these two 14 to 16 minutes and they could just have a really good match. And there's this strong backstory to it now with Deeb being a strong heel. And I get what you're saying. You just know a little too much. I think it's how some people felt about Alexa Bliss. You know, oh, we like her online persona. I don't want to boo her. But I just think kind of the pieces are in place with Deeb's sit-down interview and her finding this role of having this intense edge to her and Sheeta just being, you know, so respected and utterly likable. That's what I want to see in AEW's women's division is rivalries where there's two women who can put on a nice, good, a very good long match, but it's clear who you're supposed to be rooting for, and there's some stakes, and it feels like kind of the winner of this feud would be putting themselves in position for a shot at one of the two titles. So I know it's been kind of spread out, but I'm okay that it didn't end tonight and that there's going to be, you know, at least one more match. I do want to know where that referee was for poor Jake Atlas last week. You know, Jake blows out his knee, and the ref doesn't stop the match. He lets Adam Cole leap off and, you know, do kind of a augmented Panama Sunrise setup before then going into some sort of knee bar or leg lock. And in real life, I don't think they should have done that. I just think, you know, when someone blows out their knee, just call off the match when somebody can't continue. But, yeah, it does play into the, you know, powerbomb through the table. What are the rules? What is the guideline for referee discretion? What are, you know, best practices for referees? And are they at all consistent with it? It's like when wrestlers clear off the announce table of the monitors before they slam someone through it. And I always write, you know, wrestler A wanted to hurt his opponent, but not too badly. So he cleared off the table. Like, why would you do that? You know, so there are just some inconsistencies in wrestling, but I think some people throw their hands up and give up on it who are in wrestling, wrestlers and producers and promoters, and they go, wow, we, you know, nothing makes sense, so we're just not going to pay attention. But I think you do want to have an idea in your head of what the structure is, and don't book finishes that feel like it's an escape hatch because you don't want someone doing a job or tapping out. And, you know, did this enter that zone or not? Well, there was a pre-match attack, and they're trying to get Deeb over as this vicious, aggressive heel. So I think it escapes that condemnation, but it's borderline.
Yeah, fair enough. And I just hope that this isn't leading to a lights out unsanctioned match because I'm just traumatized AEW. Just they just put these matches on that don't deserve those stipulations. But speaking of compelling heels, though, Pac's promo, I thought. So initially when they said they're going to do a pack video package, I'm like, I rolled my eyes. I'm like, every time AEW has done a pack video package, they've shown him as this conflicted, troubled, lonely individual. And yet when we see him live, he's just a simple, athletic babyface with stable friendships. However, this time I think we're finally going to see some actual, you know, deep sort of character presentation on TV as well. Because it looks like he's turning heel. He had the blindfold on. He said he wasn't angry, that he could see more clearly. I reckon he's a new member of the House of Black. I enjoyed the Brody King debut today, even though I don't know who Brody King is, but I just think that Black needs, he needs to be a leader because when he was just he almost looked like a subordinate to Andrade El Idolo when they did that tag thing. I didn't really like him in that setting. I much prefer him in this setting. And I reckon Pac would also shine quite well here because the video packages that they do on him really are more conducive to a more heelish character, specifically a heelish character that is subservient to someone as eccentric as Malakai Black is. And I'm also excited to see him have some singles matches against, you know, a Penta, Phoenix, Penta especially, because they're very, like, Penta has a very vicious style from what I saw of him in Lucha Underground. I think him and, like, a vicious Pac could have a very, not just athletic, but also just a physical match. So what do you guys think of this?
Yeah, Patrick, you know, if you go back 2 years and listen to our post shows, and really probably a year ago, I was arguing for more elbow grease put into the shows, put time into pre-production. The word I used was pizzazz. Sometimes it just felt like they pointed a camera at the ring and had Alex Marvez holding a microphone. And it's like, come on, you know, and we saw that with Wardlow. We saw that with Pac. And they've been doing more of that lately. And I think they've struck a really good balance. And I think, you know, Miro has been part of that on a consistent basis. Where did this fall for you in terms of the vibe, the pizzazz, the production values? And was it clear to you what they were doing? And do you think they wanted it to be clear to people what they were doing yet?
I think yes to both of those last two questions. I think it was pretty clear. I loved it. I mean, I'm with you. I mean, these still work for me more than anything they do in the backstage. I think they haven't been able to really iron out what their backstage interview process is or kind of their segments are. They're very run-of-the-mill and kind of very anti what we just saw in this video package specifically. So I love this piece. I had a quote here that Pac mentioned here, "You might have blinded me, but now I see everything." And I think that speaks to, you know, something you were talking about, Hayden, as far as just really this being the antithesis of what the Pac character has been, at least in these, you know, video packages in the past, just really more subdued and more serious toned from that perspective. Love the full eye bandage as well. Mm-hmm. That was a unique look too, and really selling that Malakai Black mist. I mean, even we're seeing Julia Hart do the same with her one eye patch. I mean, just that, you know, those little touches, they're not really focusing on them necessarily, but they're just showing you that there's an impactful reaction to something like, you know, the black mist that we're seeing. So I think this worked really well for me.
All right, Hinton, anything else you want to bring up?
That's all for me, guys. I know you have another caller, so everyone go VIP. You two have a great night.
Thanks, Hinton. Appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Thanks. You too.
All right, we'll go to Bryant in Boston, as noted, and then after that, Greg in Kansas City, and we've got some emails, too, we want to get to. Bryant, thank you for calling. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight?
How are you guys doing tonight?
Good, good.
Doing well.
Good, good. At least you can hear me, so that's good. I thought the show was, it was actually really good top to bottom. You know, they, for the most part, they stayed serious and they didn't do any stupid comedy bull crap that, you know, the more serious stuff you do, the better ratings you tend to get. So it'll be interesting to see if they top a million again or if they stick close to it. But yeah, I mean, I give the show like a solid 9.5 out of 10. I mean, CM Punk Wardlow was really well done. I mean, the finish didn't make Wardlow look too bad, and it, you know, it just kind of extended the feud. So I thought that was pretty good. Wardlow came off like a star in that. Punk just came off as sort of the resilient, conquering sort of hero, even though he got the crap kicked out of him. But I think, like, this show was really about elevating young talent like Wardlow. The match between Powerhouse Hobbs and Dante Martin was pretty good. And it was kind of a nice way to get Jay Lethal back in the fold. I really liked that because I was kind of wondering where he was for a while because I used to watch Dark and stuff, but I don't do that anymore because, you know, I don't want to watch matches with no names. So, but it was nice seeing Jay Lethal back in the fold, you know, in a prominent mid-card feud. You know, Team Taz doesn't look too bad with the distraction with the distraction finish. But hey, you know, whenever I think of Jay Lethal, I think of the time he made me laugh my ass off when he did the Ric Flair impersonation the whole time in that TNA promo, Flair in the ring. That was God, good days. But there's really two points I want to hit because I mainly with the women. I actually feel the opposite of hitting on this in regards to Britt Baker. I think if they can incorporate her sort of into Undisputed Era, so to speak, or I guess maybe Paragon, since they're going to be renaming the group that or something from the rumors I've heard. But her title reign's been kind of stale because they haven't booked her as well as – because Tony Khan hasn't booked her as well as he should. And, you know, and I think kind of incorporating her into that group and maybe shunting the Young Bucks off to the side because, I don't know, I think Adam Cole needs to be free of them because they kind of drag him down. I think if she can play a prominent part in that, that can kind of juice up her title reign, her profile a little bit more. So I it's actually more of a lasting thing because, you know, she and Cole make a really good pair together, and I think it would come through on TV. So just wondering what your guys' thoughts are on that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some people act differently around their significant other than they do on their own in life. And I'm curious if we get a little window into the dynamic of Cole and Baker and if it changes how we perceive Cole or Baker, Adam or Britt, as a result of how they play off each other. Did you see it? Was there any window into that with the small sample size we had tonight, Patrick?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's more to kind of unfold there and just, you know, wait and see type approach. I took it as kind of, I think this, you know, something that Hinton brought up that I didn't necessarily agree with. I actually see these two characters really on the same level here and not one, you know, taking it back to the other, which I think is pretty empowering for, you know, Baker to be put in that position. And I think, what I would like to see is potentially, I think you're, Brian, you're getting to this as far as potentially having Cole, Baker, and Red Dragon kind of break off and really be their own super faction of sorts, which I think would be very intriguing to ultimately see how that kind of affects, you know, Omega down the road when he comes back, but, you know, more, you know, in the short term, the Bucks as well. So I think I'm really big on this, you know, as far as what came off tonight. And the Baker edition, so I'm really intrigued to see where that goes.
Yeah, I'm very open to this. I don't know if it'll work out or not, but you know, it's like I said, I'm ready for something fresh with Britt. Brian, anything else you want us in particular to comment on before we move on?
Yeah, just one last thing in regards to the women. As far as the sheeted deep match went, I really liked the way it was booked. I was kind of expecting like a competitive, longer-term match where Deeb would win. But the way they did it with the sort of cowardly heel attack at the beginning and then her just dissecting Sheeta afterwards and getting the victory and beating the crap out of her with the kendo stick, I thought that was a good way for her to kind of even up the rivalry at two matches apiece. And it really established her heel persona. And you know, I really think the TBS title thing, Jade Cargill definitely has a presence, you know, and I'm not saying she can't become a star, but I think she needs a lot more training and she's not really ready for primetime TV. And obviously some people will disagree with me on that, but, you know, I tend to think the TBS title could be further used for feuds like between Sheeta and Dee to kind of further develop that sort of women's mid-card a bit. But, you know, just this would be my last, my main last point is that Sochek and Andrew Sochek and
McMahon.
I know McMahon. Is it, what's his first name again? Rich?
Oh, Andrew. Yeah. Andrew Sochek.
No, Andrew Sochek.
And Mike McMahon.
Mike McMahon. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, I was thinking Rich McMahon. That's what I was thinking.
But, that's right. There's a lot of people around here.
Yeah, someone, another emailer has brought up a really interesting point that I think kind of cancels out the Cargill not being a very good wrestler thing. They could kind of have her do like short matches because that works. And they could bring in maybe Toni Storm because I think they're going to sign her at some point, depending on what's going on with the non-compete clause. But I think they're going to sign her. And I think bringing her in and ending Cargill's undefeated streak and winning the title and being a big name and everything, I think that would be a really good long-term potential booking idea. So wondering now what you guys think about that. And have a good night, and I'll leave you to it.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it. Yeah, Patrick, what do you think of that?
I think you're going to have Cargill have their short matches. I think the kicker there or the challenge there really is, you know, who they gonna feed to her, and she should have a longer run. I don't imagine she'll have a long run as someone like Baker in the world division would. But that's really the challenge I see with Cargill. I was all for her winning this title. It was fine, but I just don't think she's at a place with her experience to have those long matches. So I think the challenge is just who ends up getting fed to her in those shorter matches. And I like the Storm idea. I would love to see AEW sign Toni Storm, sort of have her come in and make an impact right off the bat, and you know, potentially unseat Cargill down the road would be all, you know, it would be a win for me.
All right, very good. Let's go to Greg in Kansas City. We'll wrap up our caller portion there. Greg, thanks for calling. What stood out on Dynamite to you tonight?
Hey, guys, thank you. Very, very fun conversation. I've really enjoyed the conversation tonight. So for me, a couple things, and I was listening early, and then I tuned out. I had tuned out for a bit, and then I joined back in a few minutes ago. So forgive me if these topics have already been brought up, but a couple of observations. I have one, I think, a positive observation, and then I've got a criticism of a specific aspect of the show. But first of all, the Wardlow stuff. I heard a comparison to Batista, and that this is similar to the build up for Batista with Wardlow getting the playoff of MJF, similar to how Triple H Batista played off of him. And I thought tonight was very, very solid. I mean, the man looked like a monster in the most positive way possible. So I thought that was the highlight of the show for me by far. And then my critique of the, I don't know if this has been mentioned yet, but I thought Hangman Page came off as very, I don't want to say irrelevant, but he did not feel important. That, I mean, like, he was brought out at the end of the first hour with no, I don't believe there's any promotion or hype for Hangman. Like, I don't believe he was mentioned. So it's interesting to me that he comes out at the end of the first hour of the show, almost basically unadvertised, and then is in a program with Lance Archer, which I guess is okay, but it's not going to set the world on fire. And I had observed going back to when I went to Dynamite Live that I felt like Hangman wasn't getting the reaction of a guy who was going to be in a pay-per-view main event. That was just before the Full Gear show. And, you know, maybe I'm wrong, it's subjective, but it feels to me like maybe at this point that, like, maybe he's a guy fans are willing, you know, they like, but are they willing to get behind him, like, as the top guy, I mean, at that level? I'm not sure, and I don't think he's getting much help. I thought that just having your champion come out at the end of the first hour of the show with, like, no promotion or hype, it's just, that was very, that really stuck out to me.
Are they doing enough, Patrick, in a macro sense, and then tonight specifically, to make Hangman Page's title reign feel like it is the, you know, biggest thing or tied for the biggest thing going on in the company right now? They mentioned he, I believe in the preview of the show, you know, at the top of the show, they mentioned he'd be out later. So it wasn't without some mention. But, you know, when I see David Crockett sitting at ringside, and I know a lot of people weren't watching back then and haven't heard him, but I mean, if you think Tony Schiavone gets excited when Sting comes out, if you think Pat McAfee gets excited when Boogs and Nakamura come out, you've seen nothing. You've heard nothing. David Crockett, when Dusty would come out, oh, my God. And there just isn't that person for Hangman. Now, it's a little undignified, and Hangman might not be the type to do that for. And people were critical of it with Dusty, and Pat McAfee is, you know, hamming it up. And, you know, there's you know, some diminishing returns as far as the appeal of that. But nevertheless, do you think they're doing a good enough job framing this as Hangman's company? You know, I asked him after Full Gear at the presser in person after his title win if he was going to approach his locker room leadership role any differently. And I've talked a lot, you know, off camera, and I've talked a lot about, you know, how world champions kind of define the tenor of a company. And, you know, when we think of WWE eras, we do think a lot about who the champion was at the time. And there was a certain vibe to WWF when Shawn Michaels was champion, or Bret Hart, or Yokozuna. I mean, that whole era, just when you say Yokozuna, you can just start thinking about all the satellites, you know, circulating around him as challengers and other storylines. Are they doing that with Paige? Is that even a good thing to do if they are or aren't?
So, no, in short, I would say they're not. I think the last two matches against Danielson has definitely elevated him to a level where he wasn't prior to those matches. And, you know, it's been a short period of time since he's been champion. But I even with that said, I think coming off of that last match last week into this segment didn't really get anywhere for the character. Having Lambert come out, I mean, I guess Lambert's still considered one of the top heels for good or bad. I don't know that heat was really there for him to really play off of Paige, as maybe they, you know, Tony Khan might have thought, you know, when booking this segment. But again, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think there's still time to be able to, you know, rectify it, if you want to, you know, use that word. But I think it goes back to as well. I mean, he just came off those matches against Danielson, which were big. And we're at a place where we're really not, you know, ramping up for the pay-per-view yet. So there's a lot of time. There's only, you know, almost 2 months between now and then. So I think, you know, with all this said, I think I'm going to be a little bit more patient to see where this goes, and just kind of understanding that, you know, we're in that leeway period. And I think if we can have Archer be that full heel and be a really good counter to the Paige character, I would be okay with that.
All right, Greg, anything else you want to bring up?
Yeah, just a couple of quick comments to wrap up would be, first of all, I believe going back to the conversation on the rankings in terms of, like, Lance Archer and the rankings and the rating system and the inconsistency of how it needs to be used, I believe Will Hobbs is listed as I believe he was listed going into the year the top five challenger. He lost the match on TV tonight, so there's that. And I also wanted to ask, was the match where Rudy's Brandon alluded to too much was going on, was that the, by chance, was that the Pac, was that the Penta-Matt Hardy match?
Was what the Penta-Matt Hardy match? I'm sorry.
Oh, there was a reference earlier to one match having, like way too much going on. It was a surprise at, like, a lack of mentioning of it on social media, and I thought it might have been the Penta-Matt Hardy match.
Patrick?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I don't recall offhand. That makes sense, though, based on kind of how that match did flow. But I don't remember that comment specifically.
Oh, okay. And I guess just the final comment will be, I agree with the previous caller that there was a lot less of, like, the quote-unquote comedy that I'm personally not a fan of. And if it means that, like, maybe even bringing Britt into the Adam Page story is going to mean less of the stuff that I personally don't care for, then I think that's a net positive. And I got a kick out of Britt getting in the way of the Young Bucks kiss to Adam Cole. So that'll wrap it up for me, and thank you.
That was a fun moment, you know, and I thought the Bucks played off it well. Like, well, okay, you know, you are a couple. I guess we can step aside for that. No one else, but for that, we can. Greg, thanks a lot. Patrick, anything you want to add to anything you had to say?
No, I don't think so. I think that was well said. I don't think I would add anything.
All right, so we got an email here from David Bryant from North Carolina. He writes up our AEW Dark Elevation reports at pwtorch.com. I highly recommend his entertaining, thorough write-ups of that show. He's a big fan of the quips from the commentators, and his asides throughout the report are just a blast to read. So go to pwtorch.com, go to the AEW Dark section, and check out his reports on Elevation. He writes, hey, I'm listening to your show live and loving it. I wanted to write in about Britt Baker, though. An earlier caller said he felt they'd ruined Baker tonight, and I just can't agree with that. I respect his opinion, but I'd like to make a case for why pairing Baker and Cole with Cole wasn't confusing. Both characters are tweeners in the truest sense of the word. They both look like they shop at the same punk rock thrift store, send Christmas cards from Spencer's, and drink blue motorcycles because it has the word motorcycle in its name. Also, the announcers have heavily hinted at Baker and Cole being in a relationship before, and I think they outright mentioned it tonight. Even if I'm mistaken about them explaining it tonight, you're not. I feel like the audience would have figured out they were in a relationship when Baker started tonguing Cole's throat, like his tonsils were the antidote for a common cold. All right. So an endorsement for this not being out of the blue and people picking up on it. I also think, by the way, there's a little value, Patrick, in not in a casual viewer sort of feeling like I want to learn more and I need to, you know, do more research, watch more to catch up. You know, I mean, there's some value in not being able to catch up on the entire product and everyone's backstory by watching two episodes of something, you know, and that's part of the adventure and the journey of being a fan. I didn't have everything explained to me the first time I tuned in to my first pro wrestling show. I had to kind of pick up on clues as I went along because I knew I was a newbie at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good point. I mean, and I think, you know, if you're seeing it's one thing to hear a reference that is kind of random and kind of off to the side, and it's, you know, referencing something that happened on BTE. It's a little bit different when you have these two pretty strong heel characters, you know, kissing on screen. To your point, you know, obviously there's something happening here. I should be in that loop. I think relationships and stories like that, centering around relationships, people actually, you know, do care about and want to feel connected to people. In many ways, you know, celebrities, entertainers, et cetera. So I think this is a little bit different than that. Maybe surpasses that sphere a little bit. So I would agree with you. And by the way, I had to Google blue motorcycle drinks. I had no idea what that was. So
so fill us in.
Okay, we have, let's see, a cocktail shaker filled with ice. There's the vodka, tequila, rum, gin, blue carousel, oh, sour mix. And lemon lime soda. So there's a lot in there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is this news to you too, by the way? Am I not aware?
Yeah, yeah, it is.
Okay, good.
I was trying to think of the, in my 20s, what the go-to drink was when I wanted to have a hangover the next day. And this sounds like it rivals it.
It
in terms of
could.
the mix of alcohol. I cannot mix alcohol anymore. I've got to stick with one spirit throughout the evening. Yeah. I'm trying to think the name of that drink.
Was it a Long Island? No.
Oh yeah, Long Island.
Long Island. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. 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 Trying to think. Oh man. All right. I don't want to think about that. All right. Also, I love Pac's video package. This is still David Bryant. Well, it might not have been in the exact same vicinity as Meryl's clips. It at least shares a parking lot. Do you think this is leading to a Pac versus Black feud? Because it looks like Black is going to continue feuding with the Varsity Blondes, and maybe Penta. Or maybe I misread that segment entirely. What do you guys think? Thank you so much for reading my email. As you know, I love the Torch. Everyone, please go VIP because it's well worth it. And please read my Dark Elevation reports because they're free and everyone likes free stuff. I kind of sat out because I'm not sure where the Pac thing is going. I just thought it was intriguing and well-produced and laid the groundwork for some follow-up.
Yeah, I actually felt the opposite. I agree it was great and, you know, intriguing. I guess my point there is I thought it was clearly tied to Malakai Black, especially the eye bandage, talking about him seeing everything now, things like that. So I took it literally as that being a connection back to that that feud. And I actually, as much as, you know, I watch of AEW, and you would think I wouldn't, you know, admit this, but I didn't think on the surface that I should say I forgot that they were feuding at a moment, you know, recently, because it's been a little bit of a while and we haven't really heard or seen from Pac. So it was actually really good to just revive that memory too, and just see that, you know, that be, you know, brought back to the surface.
Yeah, that makes sense. Another email on, this gets brought up during the email. JB from Detroit says, I'm not exactly sure what they're trying to do with the Elite versus former Undisputed Era groups right now. If Adam Cole and team are supposed to be heels, I think they're doing a bad job at getting him heat. Cole has an entrance and catchphrase that everyone loves to chant along with, and he's great on the mic. Also, it was obvious to me that having Britt Baker run out and be part of the angle would certainly get a babyface pop, also hurting the heel character that she is supposed to be playing. I don't think the Best Friends are currently the best or the hottest face team to use as foils against Cole and company, especially Statlander against Baker. If you got a second point, but as far as that goes, do you think AEW cares whether Cole and Baker at this point are cheered or booed, or if they're taking sides pro or con, Red Dragon or the Young Bucks, or are they just all in on, hey, 70% of our feuds are going to have a face and a heel. You know, 70% of our matches are, maybe 80 or 85% are, but sometimes we're not. We're just going to take established wrestlers, and it's not going to be black and white, and we're going to tell the story and let the fans choose. And then, you know, when they split off, they'll kind of have a landing place as a heel or a face for their next feud. but they're not wrapped up in it. Because I don't know if it's clear right now if the landing place after we kind of work through the Bucks Red Dragon jealousy with Adam Cole, I don't know if jealousy is a word, but, you know, whatever's going on with them, I don't know if it's clear where they want to land yet. And I think it's even possible they don't know yet. They just know this is a story that they want to tell with some built-in ambiguity.
Agreed. I also think, you know, to that end, the Elite, specifically the Bucks, Omega, even Page, when he was involved, they take that slow burn approach in their storylines. And a lot of the things you just said certainly fall in line with that. I would liken that to maybe a Breaking Bad TV show or Better Call Saul, where, you know, bits and pieces come out. You don't really know how to piece those, that puzzle together. By the end of that season, by the end of the, you know, even the actual series, everything comes into play. And I think that is the uniqueness of the Bucks and how they, you know, they kind of take the approach of their storylines, Omega as well, others that have kind of come into that ecosystem. That's kind of, I think, aligns really well to how you phrased it. And that's how I read it too.
All right. So the second point is, I actually think that Brody King was supposed to debut last week as being part of the House of Black with Malakai, and then the plan was derailed by the unexpected injury to Rey Fénix. I think the continually fading of the lights in and out was a giveaway, and it would have made a lot more sense on the TBS debut. Speaking of the House of Black, who else do you think would be a good fit for this new stable, if you think anyone else even should be added? Love the show, and go VIP. I mean, AEW is the land of stables, and Malakai Black, perhaps, well, for sure with Brody King, and then also possibly Pac, is a good starting point. Is there anyone else in AEW or out there as a free agent that you think would fit? And by the way, male or female, maybe Abaddon shows up repackaged in the House of Black. I don't know.
Yeah, I was trying to think of a female, and that's a perfect name. I would hope she would be repackaged a little bit. There was a name that floated out there not too recent, you know, maybe a week or two ago. I saw online, and I thought that was a perfect name, and the name escapes me. I do think that there's something though that, you know, we saw maybe a little bit tonight with Julia Hart wearing. I think she had a black top, and obviously that black eye patch still selling the mist. So maybe that's something, maybe nothing, but that would be an intriguing kind of turn, I think, especially for what, you know, what the character she's playing now and where she could take that.
It would explain, you know, why they chose to do this feud too. You know, if they had something in mind as a kind of a long-term, you know, shock, which you've just ruined with your wild speculation there.
Yes, yes.
All right, Zach in Texas. Zach in Texas is up next. Zach in Texas says, I was over the SuperClick Best Friends feud. However, they pulled me back in with this mixed tag. I need to see that brick house that is Statlander Slam Adam Cole. Speaking of the Galaxy's Greatest Alien, I'm sure a lot of people are going to be down on the Statlander Hirsch segment, but I'm pretty sure that was Layla's first live promo. It wasn't great, but at least there's a story there. I can't wait to see Hirsch snap and suplex Statlander across the ring. Serena Deeb and Sheeta continue to prove they can't have a bad match. Yes, it was short, but it was exactly what it needed to be. Deeb said she was going to hurt Sheeta and make sure she didn't walk out on her own power, and she did that. Sheeta has a commitment in Japan, from what I've heard, so she should be gone for a month or so. I can't wait to see what blow-off match they can put together and what stipulation they choose. Any thoughts on any of that, Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the last comment there about the Sheeta and Deeb match, I mean, I didn't know about Sheeta's commitment to Japan, so that's interesting. And that's even better, I think, as far as if they're going to further this feud, which it looks like they will, they should be closer to the pay-per-view by then. So I do think and hope that they'll have a nice blow-off to the feud at that point. And then just, I guess, the only thing that stuck out to me is the Hirsch backstage promo that she was involved with. Definitely, I think a caller made mention of this earlier, you know, just didn't come off that great. That said, you know, again, you know, we don't hear much from her. So I'm more accepting of this, and anything that's not a scripted promo is fine with me. So if you're working through your promos in that regard, as a viewer, you know, I'm pretty patient with that stuff.
Yeah, yep. All right, James in Clemson said, I'd like to get in on the Baker-Cole segment. I like this segment, but I didn't at the same time. I think I would have been okay with everything if it were anyone except for Baker. Okay. She's a world champion. She should be the star of any segment she's in. While it may be, quote, fun to see her with her boyfriend for a night, I just don't like the thought of seeing one of AEW's world champions playing the side piece for somebody who has no titles. I just have too much respect for Britt for that. What do you think? I don't think Britt came across as like an appendage to this. I thought she stood front and center.
Yeah.
And almost, I mean, it was interesting, and that's why I talked about the dynamic between them, but I don't think she seemed like, you know, she was like, oh, I'm with my man and I must be subservient and play second fiddle to him. She seemed pretty in control. And I mean, she's no like wilting flower behind the scenes. I mean, to a point of controversy behind the scenes. I mean, she is very strong willed about how she's portrayed, about the attention that her segments get. She's very forthright in asserting what she wants to do and how she wants to do it. I don't really fear that she's going to come across as subservient or there's a better word, a slightly better word than subservient I'm searching for, but to Adam Cole.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I think she asserted herself in that segment. I was kind of surprised to hear this kind of thread throughout the night, you know, on the show, just talking through this, because it didn't come off that way to me at all. I thought, I don't know if this is what you're looking for, but she wasn't playing second fiddle to Cole. I thought she was either at least on equal footing or even actually, you know, maybe domineering to some degree. I'm not sure if that was the case either yet. But, you know, I go back to something I said earlier. This, you know, I think her presence with him and, you know, thus Red Dragon 2 is just fortifying that type of faction and really could even be better for her character and Cole's as well.
All right, we will wrap up here with Ed in High Desert, California, as far as mailbag goes. Good evening, Wade and Patrick. This was a so-so episode of Dynamite. The Punk Wardlow stuff was ridiculous. Punk taking all those power bombs and still crawling back into the ring makes no sense. Either the ref stops the match because it's clear Punk can't defend himself, or they both get counted out. Still lays the groundwork for MJF Wardlow. Do you think Punk has lost a step or two in the ring and out of it? He's lost a little shine, I think, at least. I don't have a big enough body of evidence to draw that conclusion, Patrick. What I've seen from Punk, I think he's progressing. I think he feels more comfortable in the ring, and I think he's in the range of where he was. I think Wardlow is a challenging opponent compared to what Punk is used to, and I think they told a very different story. I think Punk, to me, the headline from the match is just how generous Punk was as this highly paid big shot coming into AEW. And you know, I reported on a Focus on AEW VIP podcast when somebody asked a question about Punk and MJF and if it seemed like they were crossing any lines because the content was so, you know, it cut sharply. Some of the comments, especially by MJF, but even Punk. You know, Punk has a good reputation for what I've heard behind the scenes, being a cool guy, cool dude, and visible and talking to young guys and getting to know people. And so this, I think, wins him over even more fans, you know, in the locker room. And, you know, Cody has done that a lot, too, almost to a fault. Sometimes people say, well, only for his friends or you know, whatever. But he has not gone in and just, you know, plowed through everybody either. You know, he doesn't squash people who some people think he should be squashing or beating at least more decisively, more quickly. There is sort of a spirit of giving back in the locker room. And to me, I think Punk is going to score some points for how much he did to help try to create a star in Wardlow. And I get, you know, the idea, is it realistic for him to take so many power bombs and was there a better finish? I just, as I said earlier, I think AEW doesn't want to do anything but pin or submission finishes. Almost to a fault, you know, but mm-hmm, I think playing that, factoring that in, I think they went about telling the story in a way that they felt would protect Punk, because my God, look at how much he did, and he still crawled back into the ring and he didn't quit. I think that all was at play in why they did what they did and how they did it. So yeah, Patrick, your thoughts.
Yeah, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but you know, I've said this a few times tonight, just going back to this show in full is really a storyline show. And this match was a storyline match, and it did its job, to your point, as far as just having Wardlow dominate, having, you know, Punk be subservient in that regard to Wardlow. And I think, you know, I think it made sense. Again, get the larger story at hand is twofold. One, to have MJF, you know, get one up on Punk, you know, by unleashing his monster on him. And then two-hand having that backfire and Wardlow, you know, teasing that, you know, ultimate dissension against MJF. So we're going to see that at some point too. So again, just thinking about that in and of itself, as far as just the larger story, I mean, I think it was a perfectly booked piece and match and made sense. Again, my only gripe was just how they got to that end. But again, you know, the larger story won out today.
All right, then Ed in High Desert says, I thought Hangman Page walking out didn't look anything like a world champ. I'm not sure what it is, but it sure doesn't look or feel like he fills the shoes. His promo wasn't good. It really didn't go anywhere. After Dan Lambert came out, which I enjoyed, I like his energy and promos are fun. After Lambert, Page finished stronger with the promo. I'm curious to see if a big man match for Page will help me see him better than all the flip-flopping matches. So, yeah, we kind of covered that earlier. The interim stuff is silly, the interim title. I see Eddie Kingston as AEW's Mankind Mick Foley. Foley helped propel Undertaker, Triple H, and The Rock. Mankind winning the belt was the change in the Monday Night Wars. I think Kingston has a ton of opportunity to help raise these guys to another level. And even has a story to capture the world title at least once. I think AEW missed an opportunity in the Kingston-Punk feud to set Kingston up better. Should have transitioned Kingston to a face and Punk as a heel. Any thoughts on those thoughts from Ed?
Yeah, I'd have to think back to the Kingston Punk feud a little bit just to kind of, you know, revive my memory about, you know, where they pivoted from there. But I agree. I mean, I think there's so much more you can do with Kingston. I think maybe he's lost a little bit of luster as a face coming out of that Punk feud. I'm not really a fan of this whole. I'm okay with Jericho Kingston ultimately. It sounds like It looks like that's where they're going. I think that's intriguing. Between now and then, though, the 2.0 piece is just not sexy in that regard. So I'm not looking forward to that, but I'm trying to get over this hump and waiting for that Jericho Kingston feud to see where that, you know, takes us.
I thought it was noteworthy just to see Inner Circle kind of standing together again. It felt, I don't know when the last time was, maybe it was last week and I just forgot, but I don't think so. It seems like it's been a while. You know, especially Jake Hager. And they just kind of had a segment as a faction. And I think it's good to do that regularly.
Agreed. Yeah. And the only thing to add to that, I guess, would be, and maybe I was confused, but one by one, the Inner Circle members walked away from Jericho. And I know they looked like they were staring down Kingston at the time, but Santana even made a comment like, you know, you two have to cool it or something to that effect. So That was intriguing to me. I'm not sure where they're going to be taking that.
Patrick, anything else you want to add before we wrap up here? Anything in your notes or that we didn't cover or you want to follow up on?
No, thanks, Wade. I think we did. I think we covered, you know, all the high points tonight. And again, thanks again for having me.
What's coming up on the Pathcast, the 90s Pathcast this week?
We haven't recorded yet, but we have a pretty good issue here as far as if you're into steroids and the steroid drama, that is 1992. This is all about you. So I do have the cover title in front of me. It has to do with Billy Graham saying, I injected Hogan with steroids. So if that doesn't intrigue you enough to join us, I don't know what will, but yeah.
All right, very good. Patrick, great talking to you. Thank you so much. Thanks to our callers, our emailers, our listeners. We appreciate it. And until next time, Wade Keller, on behalf of everybody, signing off.